This podcast is from Allegro Non Troppo on Joy Melbourne 94.9 radio station, Melbourne, Australia, and is produced for you by Adam, Peter and Robert. You're listening to Allegro Non Troppo across Australia on the Community Radio Network, presented by Adam Stobbs and Peter Forte from radio station 3JOY, Australia's first gay and lesbian radio station. We have some regular guests on Allegro who are great contributors to the social and political growth of homosexuals. It's great to have Dr. Dennis Altman back this week.
Homosexuals have been able to make a lot of changes to Australian society, like lobbying politicians and political parties to bring about change. There are gay and lesbian rights groups in every state.
Lobbying politicians and working with state and federal governments to bring about change is good.
There is another way that the GNL community impacts on governments. In this case, it's local and perhaps state government, and it's through the impact of small business and not so small ones.
I recall reading a study that looked at the economic impact of Mardi Gras in Sydney. At its peak financial impact, it was $99 million for local business. When I was working with Midsummer, there was a report from a PhD student in from Monash University who researched and said that Midsummer had, and I think because I can't find the report, an impact of $29 million on local business.
It's through these massive financial contributions that we see governments now courting the gay community festivals to support local business. Looking at Victoria, we have Midsummer and Pride March in January, but the regional and rural festivals are growing. Chill Out in Daylesford and the Spring Migration in Yakandanda.
If the gay and lesbian community decides not to hold a festival or relocate, it sets off the alarm bells of local government. We'll talk about these and other issues today with Dennis Altman. Welcome back, Dennis Altman.
Hi, Adam. Hello, Peter.
How are you going?
Well, better than you, I think.
Oh, yeah.
I should explain to the listeners that Adam has a migraine and I have taken a vow to be nice to him.
Oh, yeah. Thank you, Dennis. But you're always nice.
Well, to be nicer than usual.
Okay, I'll try not to throw up on air. That's the hardest thing not to do.
Oh, Dennis, as long as
I haven't, by the way, promised to be nicer to Peter.
No, well, that's all right. I can take whatever comes.
Dennis Altman, we have you in regularly on Allegro Non Troppo about twice a year because you are so active in the wider community. You've involved in a lot of things. You are a professor of politics, is that right?
That is right, yeah.
At La Trobe University.
Yeah.
Okay, but you're involved in lots of other things. Now, what I wanted to start off talking to you about today is you've been gallivanting around the globe for a couple of very important conferences to do with HIV/AIDS. Tell us all.
Well, I think the one we should really talk about, Adam, is the regional AIDS conference, which was held in Bali in August. Every 2 years, there's a large regional AIDS conference, regional meaning Asia Pacific, which alternates with the big international conferences, which are held on a scale that is really rather like a trade fair. So you will get something this coming year, next year. It'll be in Vienna, and I would expect something like 25,000 people. The regional conferences are obviously smaller. There are about 5,000 people in Bali. What was, I think, most impressive about it was the support from the Indonesian government. And the president of Indonesia gave a very strong opening address. And interestingly, in his opening address, spoke quite specifically about vulnerable populations, including gay and transgendered men, used those words, and was very supportive of organisations among those communities. Now, for an Indonesian politician to do this, and remember we are talking about the largest Islamic country in the world, is enormously significant politically. And I think that if nothing else had happened, the fact that the conference allowed the stage for the president to do that probably justified the huge amount of time and effort and let's face it, money that goes into organising these sorts of events.
Mm. So that was the most positive outcome from this conference?
Look, I'm a deep cynic now about international AIDS conferences, and I have to be careful because I still go to them because I'm on the governing council of the International AIDS Society, so my cynicism is obviously tempered by self-interest. But I think their real point is they succeed in a certain sort of political mobilization which keeps the focus on an epidemic that hasn't gone away and that in some parts of the world continues to grow. So that the real significance of having the regional conference in Indonesia is that one of the parts of Asia where the epidemic is still increasing quite quickly is Papua, Indonesian Papua, and of course across the border Papua New Guinea. And the focus in Bali, therefore, was to some extent on that part of the world. I think these sorts of conferences really have to have that sort of political payoff. You can't any longer, I think, claim that they are necessary for the sharing of new scientific information. There are much better ways of sharing that. They are important in building networks. They're important in giving people who are working in HIV/AIDS a sense of community, of, in a sense, recharging their batteries by getting together. But in the end, for me, what's important about them is they make political interventions.
Political intervention. Do the political interventions go so far as to be highly critical of the massive pharmaceutical companies that see AIDS as a huge business and financial opportunity? And there must be some companies that are making billions of dollars out of people suffering by offering them medication. Could you make
a
comment about
Adam,
that?
Well, Adam, that's a very strange way of putting it. I mean, of course, the nature of pharmaceutical companies, I don't want to defend pharmaceutical companies, but they exist to make money. That's their role. And if they sell drugs at a reasonable price, then that's probably on balance a reasonable thing. The question is, do they sell the drugs at a reasonable price? Do they prevent cheaper drug regimes? Do they stop the production of generic drugs? And all those are very real questions. But
I love putting you in this situation where you have to defend things that you don't necessarily want
to
defend.
That's right. Dennis Altman, the defender of capitalism on the Adam Stolz program. Yes, exactly.
I do it. I do it so well, I do admit. Yes, so these companies, they are by their very definition and the reason they exist is to make money. It's a bit like commercial radio. Its one function is to make money. What are they ethically obliged to do in that process? And does any of these conferences that you go to, do they put political pressure on these companies to actually act ethically?
The international AIDS movement, of which the conferences are in a sense the major meeting points, both internationally and regionally, has been really important, I think, in calling the big pharmaceuticals to account. And we've now had something like probably 20 years of political agitation around the cost of antiretroviral drugs. And there have been some very significant gains. There have been some very important breakthroughs, most particularly, and I made that reference earlier to generic drugs. Countries like India can produce a lot of the required treatments very much more cheaply than the big Western pharmaceutical companies. And there is a huge battle consistently about whether they will be allowed to do this, and particularly whether they will be allowed to export, so that, for example, it would be much more sensible for countries in Africa to get their antiretrovirals from generic producers in, say, India or Brazil than to get them from US or Swiss-based pharmaceuticals. In the HIV world, this has probably been dealt with better than in most others because of the political pressure. I mean, let's face it, the international AIDS lobby has been pretty powerful. And the rapidity with which large numbers of people in very poor countries with HIV have been put onto drug treatments over the last 5 years is quite extraordinary. Now, again, you know, you're right, Adam, you forced me. I can come on in on your program. I can end up sounding like Wilson Tuckey's best mate.
But, yes, I love it.
You know, there is a reality here. It's easy to dismiss it, to yell abuse at the pharmaceuticals, and while we're at it, let's yell abuse at the United States government, which has put more money into funding HIV treatments than every other government in the world put together, which means we should really abuse them, right?
Yep.
But the reality is, compared to the rollout of treatments for other sorts of diseases, HIV has not done badly. The last figures I've seen suggest that although we're not going to reach the target of universal access for everybody with HIV, there are quite remarkable breakthroughs, particularly in some parts of sub-Saharan Africa, where it's pretty poor and where, you know, if you had a standard illness requiring antibiotics, your chances of getting them in many parts of Africa not very good. The rollout of HIV antiretrovirals has been very impressive. Now, the real problems become how do you keep that going, which means you need a medical and health infrastructure that goes, that you cannot really blame the pharmaceuticals for. And to be honest, I get a bit sick of the, you know, your automatic knee-jerk reaction, Adam, is to yell at the pharmaceuticals. You look at someone with HIV in Zimbabwe, the person to yell at is Robert Mugabe. And right. The gang of thugs and tyrants who are running that country and mean that people are starving.
Yep.
Not much point being on antiretrovirals if you haven't got decent food and water.
Right. It's quite interesting to look at it. So the other thing I wanted to ask you about this conference then, we're a little bit off topic here, but there seems to be a bit of a light at the end of the tunnel. There seems to be a hint that a vaccine may be on the way.
Oh, look, Adam, I'm old enough. You're old enough. Even Peter's old enough.
I know, we've heard this so many
times
before.
In 1985, I was in Atlanta, Georgia, and the then Secretary of Health, the US Secretary of Health, Margaret Hexler, I think, don't quote me on her name, but you can go and check it if you're really out there and concerned, got up and said, this is in 1985, we will have a vaccine in a year's time.
Okay.
I think that is a very important cautionary tale. The last report from those Thai trials are very mixed. The best that anyone has come up with is something that may give limited protection. And my view is that limited protection may turn out to be worse than no protection, because a vaccine with limited protection will encourage people to feel, okay, I've had the injection, I needn't take precautions,
yes.
Which could in fact lead to an increase rather than a decrease in the transmission of HIV.
Very good point.
A lot of this comes down to education then, doesn't it, if they're going to distribute that vaccine.
Absolutely, yes. And it's very tricky. And, you know, you've got exactly the same thing with circumcision. A couple of years ago, the biomedical prevention people got very enthusiastic about male circumcision because there are studies that show that by and large, men who are circumcised are less likely to become infected with HIV than if you're uncircumcised. And actually, there were some people who were so enthusiastic that you felt if you're an uncircumcised male in certain parts of Africa, you were likely to be literally grabbed off the street and a knife produced and your foreskin lopped off in the enthusiasm that this program was being rolled out. Now, there are a lot of problems attached to this. And one of the problems, again, is it doesn't give absolute protection. But if you've gone through what could be an unpleasant procedure, of course, you're going to think, well, you know, now I'm safe.
Mm.
And so I think that, yes, you've got to be very careful. And Peter's absolutely right. You've got to actually explain to people that there is, at this stage, no biomedical intervention that's 100% certain. Stopping having sex is probably quite a good one, but that's not a biomedical intervention.
And it's not a realistic one either. Well, certainly isn't for any of us in this room. How are we going in Australia looking at the worldwide stage? Caring for our people and all
Look, we have a small and contained epidemic. Of course, there are increasing infections among gay men in Australia, but the increase is, I think, only to be expected, and is not, in my view, particularly alarming. People are not going to be, under any circumstances that human beings know of, always sensible. People will not always take precautions, even though they may know about them. We're a rich country. People, by and large, have access to pretty good medical care. Probably, again, if it's HIV, they, unless they're in particularly isolated areas of Australia, will have better access to good medical care than a lot of people with other life-threatening diseases. But we're talking now about an epidemic that is very much an epidemic of the developing world.
Right.
And, of course, the other thing we have to say about Australia is that we don't have the cultural and religious barriers against basic messages. It is possible, and it was possible very early on in Australia, to have needle and syringe exchanges,
yes.
Which stopped that particular epidemic. Epidemic among drug users is possibly the fastest growing one in the world at the moment. It is possible in Australia. In fact, gay organisations from the very beginning have been well funded to do prevention education, and as we know, Adam,
and to distribute safe sex packs and things like that. Yeah. And the education's been significant. It's been effective, and it's been very widespread. How effective it's been, it comes and goes. But generally, I think I would agree with you and say, yes, look, because the epidemic's quite contained in Australia, it could have been a hell of a lot worse, but it's quite contained. I think we're doing okay.
Yes, and of course, if you read the gay press, there will always be people, there are these sort of constant letters that show up in the gay press attacking the Victorian AIDS Council for not targeting the right group, for not having effective prevention measures out there. But I think by and large, I agree with Adam, over a very long period, we're now talking quarter of a century.
Yes.
We have fairly consistently had a lot of support. It would be difficult for anybody out there who is having a lot of sex to say, I don't know what the risks are. And as I say, I'm cynical enough to believe it is also impossible to ever have a zero transmission rate.
Mm. It's actually quite poignant personally talking about all of this sort of thing, because somebody who was very close to me died on this day, 1995. From a HIV-related complication. So we're just thinking about that. Our special guest on Allegro today is Dennis Altman. We're going to talk to him about a few things. We might have a music track, and then when we come back, Dennis Altman, I'm going to hear you explain why you have precipitated the GFC. We've been getting some messages from correspondents, people on SMS, thank you. We don't make a big feature of doing our SMS messages during the second hour of Allegro because we broadcast on the network, and we'll be joining the network again right now. You're listening to Allegro Non Troppo across Australia on the Community Radio Network on your local community radio station. Joining us on Allegro Non Troppo once again is Dennis Altman, Professor of Politics from La Trobe University. We've been talking in the first half of the show about his experiences in the AIDS conferences around the world. And we're going to chat a little bit about the politics of gay and lesbian community and how we can control governments through small business, because there was a really interesting situation, and I don't want to go into too much detail, but there was one of these situations where a local council suddenly decided it would turn its nose up a little bit at a gay community event, a fairly big event. And so the people running the community, the event, said, well, okay, if we can't get these particular things that we want, small little concessions, we're not going to hold the festival. And they cancelled the festival 1 year, and the local businesses absolutely screamed blue murder because they were denied quite a significant amount of their yearly income. And it's just interesting to see how gay and lesbian festivals, and I assume many other festivals, can actually be very, very useful tools to help make political change. Dennis Altman, could you comment on this?
Well, before the break, Adam, you had said that I was going to explain how I'd helped solve the GFC. I think we've come down a long way, haven't we, from the global financial crisis to local gay and lesbian festivals. Look, I think what you're referring to probably works when you have festivals in regional centres which depend heavily on people coming in from out of town. Mm. And there might be an interesting example. I know it's not the one you had in mind, so I'm deliberately using a different one. There could be an interesting example coming up with the Pride Festival in Tasmania,
right,
which is being flogged quite heavily here. And, you know, it would be interesting to know how many people living in Melbourne are going to buy air tickets, stay in hotels, go to events, eat out, you know, all that stuff by going to Tasmania. I think the reality about the festivals in big cities is that what they probably do is redistribute a bit the money that would have been spent anyway. Now, Mardi Gras is a bit of an exception because Mardi Gras is on the international gay circuit. And to that extent, and there have been a number of studies done that show Mardi Gras is a significant tourist earner for Australia. I don't think that that's true of Midsummer. Again, I'd really like to see the figures. I'd like to know how many people come to Melbourne from interstate. Mm. But remember, if all that's happening is that people in Melbourne are by and large, supporting Midsummer. This is a good thing, and it's a terrific thing for local shows and for gay venues, but it's not actually increasing the amount of money, by and large, that's being spent in Melbourne.
I do see that Midsummer's new, one of their principal sponsors is Via Australia, which is the airline that flies between overseas by Virgin. So I would assume that there's going to be quite a bit of overseas promotion for Midsummer. But you are right, because Midsummer is not such a spectacle like Mardi Gras and doesn't have this great huge sleazy party at the end of it, we're probably not seeing Midsummer as being on the international stage so much. But it is quite functional, I think, in Australian terms. You do get a lot of visitors travelling around Australia. People from Australia come to Melbourne for Midsummer rather than from overseas.
Well, and you know, there are possibilities. I'm not a marketing person, and so I'll throw out a couple of ideas. And if V want to get in touch with me and hire me at an exorbitant rate to take these further, I'm very happy. But it does strike me that the big international event in Melbourne in January is, of course, the Australian Open.
Mm.
And a lot of people do come from overseas for the tennis. And a lot of tennis fans are gay. Even more tennis fans are probably dykes, actually, given the strong interest a lot of lesbians have in women's tennis. I think you could do a really interesting marketing job where you combined...
Both together.
Don't let on that it could be 43 degrees and bushfires all around you. But you could actually... And remember, of course, January is cold in the Northern Hemisphere and a time when many people can actually take holidays. So that certainly the potential for selling it as an international tourist event is there.
The evidence of the GFC really doesn't seem to have impacted on Australia very much that I can tell, but I've just had friends and family who've been overseas, particularly to the US, and they said they went on one particular tour around Los Angeles, or they did several tours, and they said nearly all of the tours that they did, all of the people joining the tour were Australians. That there were so many Australians over in the US because the hotels over there that are suffering from the GFC are offering 80% discount. You know, so you can get for 20% of the normal rate, you can get into a lot of the fairly big hotels. So it seems to be somewhat opportunistic for us to travel at this time. That's why I'm going to South America for a month.
Well, I didn't know you were going to South America for a month, which sounds terrific. But you're right. And, of course, the other thing that's happening is the Australian dollar is strengthening. Probably has gone up a cent since we came into the studio today.
But isn't it amazing how history repeats itself? It was about this time last year, the middle of last year, when we saw the Australian dollar getting towards parity. Do you think we're going to have a W in the, you know what I'm talking about, in the graph when you look at the financial markets, how we've suddenly everything's plummeted and now it's on the way up. Do you think it's about to plummet again?
You know what I find? I mean, I'm not going to go there because I don't know. And if I knew, I could go out and make a lot of money, and I don't know. But I think what worries me is that the assumption now is, well, we don't really have to worry, the system works. And I suspect we will, I mean, and in this sense, I'm probably agreeing with you about the possibility of a W. We're going to have people again borrowing vast sums of money to invest in housing and in shares that will turn out not to be sustainable. In a world where one of our major problems is overconsumption, because overconsumption is really what underlies global warming when you start unpacking it all, that seems to me very scary. I don't want people to suffer, but in a sense, it would probably have been in the interests of the globe if the global recession had actually been somewhat longer and if the recovery were less ebullient than it appears to be at the moment.
Because it's a lot of the countries, the developing countries that are going into urbanisation, that's all contributing to this. You know, when you think about it, the global financial crisis, it's not as if there's a lot less of anything. You know, there's no great huge shortage in the world. Suddenly things haven't disappeared or not there anymore. It's more of a psychological thing. People borrowing money and putting pressure on financial markets. But in real terms, there's nothing's changed.
Well, but that's looking at it from the point of view of someone sitting in a rich country.
Mm.
In poor countries, the number of people in real poverty has actually increased dramatically because...
Has it really?
Yes, it has really. The number of people who have fallen below basic subsistence has increased dramatically because...
Where?
Pretty well every poor country because that is dependent on exports. Because the prices of export, particularly agricultural exports, was deflated by the global financial crisis. And also, of course, in as you say, we in Australia have escaped a lot of this, but certainly even in the rich world, in much of Europe and the United States and Japan, unemployment has gone up significantly. And yes, nobody probably starves if they're unemployed in rich countries, although they may come closer to the United States given its appalling welfare system. But certainly people who have got used to certain styles of living do actually suffer. I haven't seen the figures, but I would expect that there is an increase in suicide, certainly an increase in a whole lot of stress-related diseases across the world as a result of the global financial crisis. So let's not get too carried away. I mean, I know the Australian press at the moment is so busy congratulating itself on our ability to sail through this that I think we're forgetting that the global financial crisis did actually affect an awful lot of people in a very real way.
The reason I think that Australia has been somewhat softened by the whole process is because of our resource sector. But it's quite ironic in a way, because when you look at the compounding issues of the global financial crisis and then greenhouse warming and all of that, the reason we've survived is that we're selling off our brown coal to China.
Yes.
creating more global angst about the whole process. And I see recently that it looks as though Victoria is going to start selling off our Latrobe Valley coal as well. Just where do we go from here? The technology does not exist to be able to use brown coal.
Well, of course, there's a lot of speculation about going nuclear, isn't there? That's risen its head again. I believe there's more people becoming supportive of that idea.
80% of the electricity in France is generated by nuclear power. You don't hear anybody in France carrying on massive protests about it. What's so bad? It's just getting rid of the nuclear waste. We could send it to New Zealand. Nobody'd care.
I'm not going to buy into New Zealand bashing. I'm prepared to do Stubbs bashing, but not New Zealand bashing.
Well, I hope this program doesn't go to New Zealand.
No, it doesn't. But the interesting thing is it's a bit scary to think that the thing that has saved us from the global economic crisis is the fact that it's these resources of mainly iron ore and coal.
Yes.
Because we don't actually make anything.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And there is a great irony, and if one looks at the rhetoric of the current government, they really are trying to have it both ways. I mean, there is something deeply ironic about a government who, on the one hand, has a leader who says climate change is the great moral challenge of our time, but then simultaneously says, I'm going to do everything I can to increase Australia's coal exports to China, and we're going to spend vast amounts of money on infrastructure to increase our capacity.
Volume of coal that we
send. Yeah, and to improve port facilities to sell out more of it. So I think you're absolutely right. And I think that the level of inability of our political leaders to actually be honest about climate change is absolutely extraordinary. And the need to make short-term decisions which work against the long-term needs is quite scary.
Do you think, is it global warming, is it actually as bad as it sounds? There's a degree of scepticism in some circles, not in many. I tend to be a little bit sceptical myself. Looking historically through geological records, we've had massive amounts of climate change in the past. You know, is this any different, really?
Well, Adam, you and I assume Peter, are not geologists, meteorologists, or scientists of any known description. If 95% of the leading scientists who have studied this are agreed that global warming is a reality and a catastrophe if it's not prevented, I don't feel inclined to say, from my sort of gut knowledge, which is about equivalent to that of a third grader, you're wrong. Yep. And I find, I mean, to be honest, I think your comment is just deeply, deeply stupid and arrogant, because you're actually saying, oh, I don't believe this. I don't give a shit what 95% of the scientific evidence says. Yep. Somehow my feeling is more important than the science.
That's exactly right, it is. And why should
no,
I?
No, it's not.
Why
That's
should
crap,
I?
And I won't have it, and I'll walk out if you insist on saying it, because what you're saying is up there with Wilson Tuckey and the rest of the Liberal Party, who are quite happy to see the world go to hell, because it's more important to keep their own safe seats.
The one thing that will stop us going to hell is perhaps if we had a lot less people in the world. 6 billion people. It's just ridiculous trying to sustain that level of population. What do we do about that?
Well, again, of the 6 billion, half a billion are probably consuming 90% of the globe's resources. What we should be doing, if we were really serious about this, is stopping the baby boom in rich countries like Australia and feeling less moralistic about the baby boom in poor countries, where people at this stage are actually using up a little of global resources.
Oh, I never thought of it quite like that.
You're listening to Adam and Peter, and our special guest
is Dr. Dennis Altman on Allegro Non Troppo on the Community Radio Network. We'd like to thank the Community Broadcasting Foundation for ongoing support. Our special guest on Allegro Non Troppo is the regular Dr. Dennis Altman, Professor of Politics from La Trobe University. We've been talking about the global financial crisis and about the environment and about the global warming. We just had an interesting response. Somebody suggested perhaps we could use the water from the desalination plant to generate hydroelectricity. I don't think we actually could do that, because the desalination plants that we have around Australia are all on the coast, and to have hydropower it needs to be elevated. It needs to have a certain amount of elevation so you get the potential kinetic energy to turn the turbines. But it's quite interesting, Dennis Altman, to think that we could perhaps do some things to move water from one part of Australia to the other. We get massive amounts of water in the Channel Country in southwest Queensland, which ends up nowhere. We could have that piped down to Victoria. The cost of realising such a project would probably be out of the world of it actually being realistic. But did you know, through all of the dams and things that we've done across the whole face of the planet, we've slowed the rotation of the Earth down by a quarter of a second?
I didn't know.
Yeah, well,
and I'm afraid, Adam, at my age, I'm prepared to live with the great disappointment that somewhere in the long distant future we'll lose a minute.
Yes, we lose a quarter of a second every year now because of our dams and moving water across the face of the globe.
But if you take that in perspective, a quarter of a second is what? It's going to take 240 years for that to be 1 minute. As I say, at my age, I can live with 240 years.
But it's just interesting, what could we actually do if we can't solve the global warming? How could we get more water into Victoria? As it's created a lot of controversy with the pipeline they're using to bring water down from the Goulburn Valley. I mean, that hasn't been built yet, but everybody's in very upset about all of that. I don't know that there's any easy answer. Dennis Altman, what do you think are some of our other political problems as they beset the gay and lesbian community?
Oh, well, that's a big segue, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because, you know, my sense is that there are no... And I will make myself deeply unpopular and unloved by saying this. I do not think that there are huge political issues that are specific to homosexuals anymore in Australia.
Yeah.
Now, I know that people who believe that gay marriage is very important will disagree with me, but I think that we are already clearly moving to a stage where most governments will accept civil unions, and I'm perfectly comfortable with that. I think that the great political questions of our time are not ones in which any longer our sexuality is central. And that makes me in some ways both very radical and very conservative. And my opposition to, I mean, my feeling that gay marriage is not important is because I actually think marriage as an institution sanctified by the state is a historic anomaly, and that we should be spending our, if we're interested in it, we should be getting rid of it rather than trying to buy into it.
Exactly, was a point that I made some time, that marriage as it is is probably an outdated institution very much. So, I mean, it's a hangover from the Middle Ages, really. When you look at the whole way that marriage is articulated, you know, the man takes a wife. Mm. It's all about ownership. The wife traditionally takes on the husband's surname. And it's just generally unfair.
Well, the other thing that I find interesting, and I don't think there's been a real debate about, and I may be wrong, but my sense is it hasn't been properly debated in the community, is the classic marriage vows in pretty well any religious ceremony I'm aware of are about fidelity and monogamy. Now, most gay men, if they're honest, don't actually believe in monogamy, nor do they believe that real fidelity to a partner is measured by whether or not you have sex with other people. And one of my concerns about the buying into gay marriage is that it doesn't actually question what I think is an unrealistic and rather silly attitude to what real faithfulness is. And the idea that you measure the quality of a relationship by whether or not somebody occasionally goes off to a fuck club strikes me as bizarre. But people who want gay marriage presumably also want to be able to get up and vow that they will stay true to each other in the corporal sense for the rest of their lives.
Why do we sleep around so much?
Adam, is that a personal question or a collective question?
Collective question.
Well, in that case...
Why do gay men, and we all have to put our hands up, I suppose, at some stage and say, well, yes, we do or we don't, but why do generally most gay men, most of the ones I know anyway, sleep around? Why do we? Is it because we can?
Well, I think it's because we can, and I would have reversed the question and said, why don't more people? And, of course, it's easier because gay men have a whole set of institutions
which they can meet each other for sex.
Yeah.
We've constructed the most brilliant network. We've got it made when it comes to meeting people, really. I can walk out of this studio and in 10 minutes I could have somebody fairly quickly just around the corner. There are so many
probably
institutions.
Not looking how you do today, Adam. I'm sorry to say this, but I think it would take at least 15 minutes.
It's dark. But it's true. Yet heterosexuals do not have the same avenues to meet people. So why? Why have we set up this?
They have the same desires.
They have the same desire, but they don't have the same constructions to be able to access.
It's not just that, though, is it? I'm sorry. It's not just a matter of having access. It's the expectation. If they're married or with a partner, then their partners have certain expectations of them. Mm. And they don't want to think of their husband going off having sex with other people.
But it's also about gender equality. It is much more difficult to imagine a situation in which women and men could meet each other sexually in the way that we could go to a sauna and just play around with a whole lot of other men, because implicit in that is some sort of sense of equality and much less of a sense of ownership. Which is part of that traditional assumption about marriage. So I think if you had genuine recognition of equality between women and men, if women didn't feel threatened by being surrounded by a lot of men who are sexually prowling, which is, you know, let's face it, what happens in a sex venue, then you may well have that situation. But I think for most women, a heterosexual sex venue would seem far more threatening than it does to most men.
I never thought of that.
Does seem to me pretty basic. I mean, there have been attempts. And, you know, there are some gay saunas in Europe that have co-ed nights.
Yes, I think we have one in Melbourne, actually.
Yes, I think one of them might. And I'm not sure how successful they are, but what strikes me is that where they're most successful is places like Switzerland, where there probably is a much greater degree of genuine equality between women and men.
But isn't it about the way men think about sex in a different way to the way women do? I mean, they've attempted to have women's nights at some of the saunas in Melbourne, and I don't think they've been very successful.
You've got to be very careful making those sorts of generalisations.
Well, it is a generalisation.
Some women would love to sleep around, and I know quite
a few
lesbian
but
women
I'm saying
who's...
That's a generalisation.
Yeah, but what Peter's saying is actually empirically testable, isn't it? I mean, we can actually ask, and I think you're right. But then the question is, why have they not been successful? And have they not been successful because it's, after all, not part of the culture. For gay men learn pretty quickly about sex venues of one sort or another, and it's sort of part of being a gay man, and we all know about them. And even people who say, I'd never go to one, and I would never believe someone who said that, knows that they're there and that they're likely to run into a whole set of other people they know. For a woman to go to one is a much bigger step, just because they're new to the lesbian scene.
And also, it's also partially the education we get through popular culture, because that's what happens to gay men, are portrayed as being promiscuous and sleep around in popular culture. If you see it often enough, then
absolutely,
you start to believe it.
Yes, I mean, there's a generation who've grown up on Queer as Folk. And interestingly, the other night, I saw an Israeli film called Antarctica, which is almost as if Queer as Folk and the L Word got together and turned into an Israeli film. As you see all the stereotypes played out in those two American soaps. Yeah. Go get Antarctica. It's out in the DVD shops at the moment, and it's not a fabulous film, but it's really quite... What I found most interesting was seeing how close, in a Hebrew language film, were the caricatures of what gay men and lesbians do and how they interact and relate.
You've travelled around the world, but you've travelled it in a slightly different way than most of us. You haven't done it as a tourist, so you would have seen a lot of gay and lesbian cultures in other countries. Are we all the same everywhere?
Oh, look, at some level, I think what is striking to me is that people love to claim that in my culture things are different, and when they do, you can usually think of five or six other cultures a long way away that are very similar.
Yeah.
There's a limited number of ways in which human beings can behave, and I think the patterns tend to reproduce themselves. And, of course, what's different, I think, is material conditions. Mm. Things are really different if you live in Melbourne, in a reasonably affluent part of the city and have a decent job and good housing, compared to, say, living in the slums of Jakarta. And that's where things are different. Mm. And although the human instincts may be the same, the way in which you will behave to survive are going to change your behaviour.
Mm. It's quite interesting to look at, because people are the same the world over. The number of times I've travelled and I've thought, I'm going to somewhere completely different. And I've got there and I thought, it's actually not that different, really. Mm. It's the same people, same things, doing the same things. All that changes are the names of the money and the food that you eat. But the practices and everything else is about the same. The environment's slightly different, might be a bit warmer and a bit colder, but it's a terribly cynical way to look at the world, isn't it? Thinking, why bother going? Because it's just going to be the same as it is here.
Well, it depends on your reasons for going, though.
Mm.
I mean, there are various cultural differences between countries enjoy.
That's right. You can go there and experience the cultural differences. But when you go, when you travel the world and you go and visit other gay and lesbian scenes, that's the thing I've discovered the most.
Then you might as well not go, might you?
Yeah, because it's all about the same. It's the same. The only thing that changes for me personally is I know in some countries there's a hell of a lot more prostitutes.
But, Adam, that's, again, a reflection of the material reality.
Yes.
If you, as a rich white man, are in a poor Asian country, of course you are going to be... accosted by very many more young hustlers, because that's how they're going to survive.
Yeah.
But in the end, their behaviour isn't all that different to the boys down in, if it's still Tennyson Grove. I don't know if it is still Tennyson Grove.
Don't know.
I'm sure one of our listeners will be able to immediately flash up on the screen
wherever
it is that we find young hustlers in Melbourne. But, most prostitution is a function of economic conditions. So, of course, there's going to be more where the gap between rich and poor is greater.
You're showing your age, Dennis Altman. They don't pick them up like there now. It's all done on the internet, for sure.
We're going to have to wrap this up very quickly.
Dennis Altman, it's been fabulous to have you get back on Allegro and on Troppo. Once again, we always have an interesting conversation. We've had a lot of feedback from people who've been listening today. It was quite interesting since I didn't give out any contact details. So that's good. Can we have you next year?
I think next year... I probably have a few dates still empty in my diary.
That'd be wonderful. Dennis Altman, once again, thanks, Allegro. We'll be back with Allegro next week, everyone. Bye.
Bye.